Meeting of the House Committee on Civil Law will come to order. Chair recognizes a quorum. Can I have a motion for the minutes from February 12th?
So moved.
Minutes have been moved. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed say no. Motion passes. The first bill we have on the calendar, members, is House File 232. Representative Hillstrom moves that House File 232 be passed and be referred to the Committee on Judiciary, Finance, and Policy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Do you know if Commerce has requested this bill?
I don't know that, Representative Hillstrom.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, I do have a DE2 amendment. And, Mr. Chair, we have found a typo that I would like to incorporate into that amendment.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, on page 6, line 6.16, there needs to be an additional O.
Okay.
In choose or chose.
Is that the only change in the delete all amendment, Representative Hillstrom?
That is the only change to the DE2 amendment.
Okay, so that being the case, then Representative Hillstrom moves the DE2 amendment to get the bill in the shape the author would like. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed say no. Motion passes. Okay, to your bill as amended, Representative Hillstrom.
Mr. Chair, now we need to adopt the DE2 to get the bill in the shape that I
Oh, that's right. There we go. Okay. All in favor of the DE2 signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed say no. Motion passes. Now to your bill as amended, Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, this bill was brought to me by the Vulnerable Adult Justice Task Force Group, and they have been working very hard to come up with some consensus items that can be done to improve matters relating to a vulnerable adult. And so with that, Mr. Chair, I would like to turn it over to my testifier to talk about the group's work and what the proposal does here today.
Thank you. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Mr. Chair, I'm Amy McDonough. I'm the Associate State Director for Advocacy for AARP.
Thank you.
Yeah,
Ms. McDonough.
Thank you for the opportunity to testify today, and thank you, Representative Hillstrom, for helping bring this matter forward. AARP represents more than 650,000 older Minnesotans across the state of Minnesota, and one of our most important advocacy priorities is to work on efforts that curb elder abuse and financial exploitation of all vulnerable adults, including elders. And I'm here to stand in for one of those elders today who couldn't be here, who wanted to share a personal story, but we want to let you know that AARP strongly supports House File 232 because we believe it will help to curb financial exploitation by providing more protections for Minnesotans who use the power of attorney form. And here in Minnesota, we've been lucky to work on with a unique advocacy collaborative that Representative Hillstrom mentioned called the Vulnerable Adults Justice Project. It's a group of all kinds of, and I think you have a list in front of you, a group of Minnesotans who are interested in protecting elders and other vulnerable adults from financial exploitation. It includes adult protection agencies, public advocacy organizations, elder and disability organizations, healthcare providers, law enforcement, city and county attorneys, private attorneys, and other government organizations. And again, it's a really good group that brings consensus and issues forward to help protect vulnerable adults from financial exploitation and abuse. This proposal before you, like Representative Hillstrom said, was initiated by that group, and we really do believe that it will help increase protections for Minnesotans who use the power of attorney form. The power of attorney form is a flexible and affordable instrument that's used widely by individuals and families across the state, those who are planning for future incapacity. But misuse of these documents is a growing concern for those who are working to prevent financial exploitation. So the goal of this bill is really to strengthen Minnesota law, to provide some clarity for families, and to help prevent the power of attorney form from becoming a, quote, license to steal. We believe the legislation does three important things. First, it provides clarity to families and individuals who use this tool by clearly stating the roles and responsibilities of attorneys in fact. This is important because we've heard from members that the responsibilities can be confusing. The proposal will now clearly state the responsibilities to the principal and ask the agent to sign and acknowledge these responsibilities. With this new language, the agent would be on notice of his or her duties and responsibilities, and it might deter some bad conduct because we believe the actor would no longer be able to claim that he or she didn't know any better. It also states that the authority granted in the power of attorney is limited to financial matters and does not include healthcare decisions. And this misunderstanding is actually quite common. In fact, we've heard from some emergency responders. They've shared with us that from time to time during an emergency, a power of attorney is shown in the hopes that it would serve as a healthcare directive. And that's a misunderstanding that we think could be cleared up with this language. So families will better understanding that using a power of attorney does not also pertain to healthcare decisions. Second, it clarifies the limits of gifting and self-gifting, and it adds cautionary language about gifting. And then third, it provides a clear mechanism for people who grant this power to others to receive financial accounting and to have the court intervene if necessary. We believe that this will more clearly remind agents that they must account for their handling of the financial matters and to be able to, again, produce this accounting when asked. It will also help to, quote, stop the bleeding of the finances sooner than what we currently see when something bad happens. We believe this legislation certainly will not deter all bad actors who are determined to commit power of attorney abuse, but it is a strong first step towards prevention and detection and redress and a good balancing of autonomy and protection. So thank you, Mr. Chair, and for the opportunity to testify, and we'd be happy to answer any questions, and I think we have someone to walk through the bill, too.
Thank you very much, Ms. McDonough. Ms. Garby, are you prepared to walk through the bill?
Yes.
Great. Thank you. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
I'm Laura Garby, and Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, I'm an attorney, and for the past 6 years I have worked in the field of estate planning and elder law. I'm also co-chair of the Vulnerable Adults Justice Project Working Group on the Power of Attorney. I'm here to speak in favor of House File 232. Ms. McDonough has testified to the objectives of this legislation, which include clarification that the power of attorney is for financial matters only, the roles of the attorney in fact, gifting, and the addition of a judicial relief mechanism. My testimony will focus on the substance and the presence in the process to present the DE2 amendment. But first, just a few words about terminology. In Minnesota, we use the term principal for the person who is appointing someone else to manage finances or sign documents on his or her behalf. We use the term attorney, in fact, for the person who is given the duties and the authorities. The bill includes the addition of a notice to the principal as well as a notice to the attorney, in fact, in the statutory short form power of attorney. The notice to the principal allows the principal to understand the form they are signing. It explains the purposes and powers granted in the power of attorney form, as well as the duties they are granting to an attorney, in fact, and how to terminate the power of attorney if needed. The information contained in the notice is not new and is currently found in the statute. However, since most people don't read the statute and many power of attorney's forms are signed without the benefit of legal counsel, the notice provides the principal information about the form he or she may not know or understand the extent of the powers that are included on the form. For someone who downloads the form from the Internet, this is the only way the important information from the statute comes through. We believe informed principals can make smarter decisions regarding who to name as their attorneys in fact. The notice to the attorney in fact serves a similar purpose. The notice contains the duties an attorney in fact has to the principal once the attorney in fact uses his authority under the power of attorney form. Again, these duties are in the current statute but are not spelled out on the current form. We believe providing attorneys, in fact, with a list of their duties will decrease misuse of the power of attorney, especially among attorneys, in fact, who have no intention of utilizing their powers for the wrong reasons. The bill adds language requiring the attorney, in fact, to sign the form, stating they have read and understood the notice. For those who misuse the power of attorney, the addition of this language will weaken a defense of not knowing or understanding their duties. The bill also clarifies that the power of attorney is to be used for financial transactions and does not give the attorney, in fact, the authority to make health care decisions. In the first section on the statutory short form power of attorney, line N, the word financial has been added to the power. The bill allows the principal the option of allowing one attorney, in fact, the option to self-gift but not give the same authority to a second or a successor attorney, in fact. This change allows a married individual the opportunity for his spouse to gift to herself but not allow a child to gift to himself. The current power of attorney forces a principal to decide if all or none of the attorneys, in fact, can self-gift. The bill also changes the amount an attorney, in fact, is allowed to self-gift to him or herself. The current statute allows the self-gift to be limited to $10,000, although this amount is not on the form. The bill proposes to change the amount of the self-gift limit to match the federal gift tax exclusion and makes it clear on the form this is the limit. It also clarifies that a gift to the attorney, in fact, includes a gift to anyone the attorney, in fact, has a legal obligation to support. Lastly, the bill includes a judicial relief mechanism allowing a principal or interested party to petition the court for an accounting when the attorney, in fact, fails to provide one. It also provides the principal or someone named on the power of attorney form to receive the accounting to recover attorney fees and court costs. In all, we have worked to balance the objective of protection from financial exploitation with the objective of maintaining a planning instrument that is widely available and doesn't require legal counsel or costs. As mentioned by Ms. McDonough, the Vulnerable Adults Justice Project is comprised of a wide range of professionals. In addition to these members, our working group has met with governmental agencies as well as representatives from three sections of the Minnesota State Bar Association. The DE2 amendment results from our outreach beyond VAJP. Thank you for the opportunity to speak on behalf of the bill. I'm happy to answer any questions you may have.
Thank you, Ms. Garvey. Questions? Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. First of all, I applaud you for trying to make some changes to this, and I've used this short form both as an attorney and just as for family members and so on. So I've had some little bit of experience with this, but so I wanted to just ask a couple of things. First of all, I always found that this attorney in fact terminology is really confusing for people. And so since you brought it up, why do we have to stay with that terminology? Isn't there something we could use that would make that simpler?
Ms. Garvey?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Liebling, I agree. We did discuss changing the terminology from attorney in fact to maybe just an agent, but we were worried that there were so many changes being made, we didn't want to make more changes that would cause reactions from people that would cause confusion. So we kept the same language, just made the changes we made.
Representative Liebling?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, okay, I can see that in terms of maybe a bill going through, the keeping it a little bit simpler. But for the user, they're probably looking at this for the first and only time. So I think that I'd like to see that get simpler if there's any opportunity to continue to work on that. Another couple of things wanted to ask, why do we have to give people the power to make a gift at all on behalf of somebody else? I mean, there's a lot of effort in here to sort of tamp down on that and make sure it's not used inappropriately, but give me an example of why I would want to give somebody the power to make gifts for me. If I'm incapacitated, why do people need to get gifts from my property?
Ms. Garvey.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Liebling, the ability for an attorney, in fact, to gift to others or even to themselves is used widely in estate planning. As people age or if they are ill and they have an estate that is going to be taxable, they want the ability to be able to gift to people before death, particularly up to the federal gift tax exclusion.
Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Sharon. Okay, you know, I've sort of forgotten about that piece of it because I sort of think of this short form thing as being used by people who are sort of not in that category where they're going to need that kind of estate planning. So that's something else that you know maybe smarter people have already thought about this and who's going to be using it, but I would think that would be sort of peeled off and that would be something that wouldn't be this statutory short form deal. But the other question I wanted to raise is about the health care directive. And I think it's good that you're letting people know that this is not that. But I wonder if there isn't a way to add to this something to encourage people to think about doing that. Because it's something that is very underused and something that in another context I've worked on with some folks to think about how we can encourage more people to do that. It would just be beneficial if more people thought about having a healthcare directive. And so since we're taking the trouble in here to say this is not that, I wonder if there wouldn't be a way to say, encourage people to take that next step, and then I'll finish up, Mr. Chair.
Okay.
Thanks.
Thank you, Representative Levy. Did the author want to take that? Or?
Certainly, Mr. Chair. Representative Liebling, that was not part of the discussion of this group and whether or not they wanted to encourage people to do health care directives. So at this point, I think that group can talk about it, but at this point, I'm not prepared to move in that direction. This really is a consensus bill with all of the parties getting together, and I try to keep consensus bills with the things they have consensus on.
Representative Simon.
I'll pass. My question has been answered. Thanks.
Okay, thank you. Representative Howell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I want to pick up on what Representative Liebling was saying. My concern is coming from my background of being deployed a few times and having family members of the deployed take advantage of their powers that they get with a power of attorney. My concern is that that's why I'm very interested in making some changes, because there's been widespread abuse of that. My concern is going down what Representative Liebling said. Many people use this, and when you've got it configured to take care of those folks that are vulnerable or in estate planning, and it's geared towards that, I think we skew it not to be user-friendly for those folks that normally use it for other matters. And that's what I'm concerned about when you put the gifting in and the attorney of fact. I think simpler is better, and as long as we're going through the process of making changes in statute, I would like to see it so it's user-friendly and we don't have to revisit it in a year or two to try and make additional changes. So if we're going to make changes, it'd be good to make those language changes. And when we talk about, you know, that it's nice and easy for the folks making estate planning, it may be more confusing to those folks that just want to have my bills paid and I'll take care of it when I get back and that type of thing.
Representative Hillstrom, you want to take that? Or Ms. Garvey?
Mr. Chair, Representative Howell, I do understand your concerns, and that has been part of the challenge of making changes to any power of attorney form, because the form is widely used. It was designed to be widely used by everyone. So we understand the concern about the gifting, but we also felt that it is not something we could take out because we wanted consensus. So we tried to change the gifting so that people could nominate one attorney, in fact, to be able to gift specifically a spouse, but not give children or another person the ability to gift. So we're trying to strengthen it, but we do not believe we could reach any consensus if we would remove it completely.
Representative Howell?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And then I think there's just one, as long as we, you know, and I know that we can't fix it here, but I think there's a slight typo on page 3. I by looking at how the A's, the numerical flow happens there, if you look at where A starts at the first line and then has the additional information, I believe the N should be on 3.33 and not 3.34. Because you should be making the choice at the beginning of the sentence, not at the end. So that's just a point of reference. I know I can't offer an amendment here because it's got to be 24 hours in advance, but
something like that.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. He is, in fact, correct, and that is a technical amendment, so we have no objection to him offering the amendment to make that change.
So we'll can we have Mr. Gehrig state the amendment?
Okay. The amendment would be to strike the dots and the N in parentheses on line on page 3.34, and to place the dots and the N in parentheses on line on 3.33.
Okay, everyone understands the amendment. All in favor of the oral amendment as stated, signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
All opposed, say no. Motion passes. Okay, thank you, Representative Howe. For that. That's why we do this.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. There's also another spelling error or an additional duplicated word that was just located by someone in the audience. On line 1, line 1.10, there is two A's. So it's subdivision 1B and AA specimen. So if we could just get some clarification from staff about whether there's should be only one A or somehow delineating that.
Ms. Mullen, can you tell us if there should be one A there or two?
I believe the A that's underlined is a typo, so it would be to strike the A that is underlined on page 1, line 1.10.
All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed say no. Motion passes. The A has been stricken. Representative DeRusso.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have had experience with this as a person who had the power of attorney for on behalf of my mother. And I, first of all, applaud the idea of including more details about the powers and limitations in the form, in particular highlighting such things as the fact that it expires upon the death of the principal and so on. And just in addition to circumstances under which the attorney, in fact, might be making gifts on behalf of the person, because I was handling my mother's bill paying and all of that for her, and that involved also making gifts to the grandchildren, gifts to the siblings, and so on. So there's a broad range of circumstances, as we've heard before, under which people might be using these powers.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Hillstrom.
That is correct, and the person who is signing this has the option to not grant anyone the authority to gift. This just says you may give someone the authority to gift and list who that person is.
Representative Neuberger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Good morning. Representative Hillstrom, I want to applaud what you're trying to do here. I think this is necessary. I also want to echo what Representative Liebling had said. I bring a unique perspective to this. You're all familiar with my background. I can tell you right now that there's nothing more frustrating and stressful when you walk into a situation where a family member has just fallen over dead. 911 is called, and we arrive. If we have an advanced health care directive, that's wonderful, because that reflects the wishes of the person that has just passed. When you don't have those and you have family members who are not familiar with the form and the structure of a power of attorney, they're there trying to, I can't tell you how many times I've been there where they're flipping through the paperwork trying to make an advanced medical direction decision based on something that doesn't pertain to that. It's very confusing, and it sets the tone of an emergency situation as one that's very cumbersome and hard. I would like to consider possibly some kind of language in this. If I walked in to an emergency situation and someone wasn't sure how this works, and they dig through the paperwork, and the very first thing across the top was writing that it says not for medical direction. that would save countless hours and countless headaches of angst when you walk into a situation of that type. So I just want to encourage you to possibly consider having something up there that says this does not apply to medical situations. You'd be doing the emergency community a great service by doing so. I just something to think about. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Newberger. Representative Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just wondering, I know in the original draft there were some damages and penalties for not following this statute, and just wondering what the reasoning was behind removing those.
Ms. Garvey.
Mr. Chair, Representative Scott, we did remove those after we outreached to different individuals and groups, and we found that it was not warmly received, and they had valid reasons for not having those in there, so we did remove it.
Okay, thank you.
Any other questions for members of the committee? And seeing none, then the motion is that Representative Hillstrom ask House File 232 be passed as amended and re-referred to the Committee on Judiciary Finance and Policy. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed say no. Motion passes. Thank you. Thank you.
I know. They can make all the medical decisions. They can't, but they don't know. And so you've got an obligation to anybody. And there is the gray area.
And next on the agenda is House File 84, Representative Lesch. Would you like to move your bill? When he gets back to the table there.
If you give me one moment.
Sure.
Thank you, Madam Chair, for the hiatus. House File 84, members, is dog and cat breeder licensing and inspection provided for and money appropriated. Members, this has been a six-year saga that we have worked on this bill.
Representative Lesch, before we begin, you want to move your bill?
Yeah, I thought we just did that. No.
No. No.
Thank you. I would move that House File 84 be recommended to pass, and where is it going, Madam Chair?
To Public Safety Finance.
Thank you, and be re-referred to Public Safety Finance.
Representative Lesch moves House File 84 be passed and re-referred to the Committee on Public Safety Finance and Policy.
May I proceed, Madam Chair?
Please present your bill.
Thank you. House File 84 has been through many changes over the last 6 years. We've had a lot of input from breeders, small breeders, animal welfare advocates, veterinarian citizens, and the Board of Animal Health. It originally was 19 or 18 pages, and we've whittled it down to 9. We have made a lot of compromises on this bill. Members, when you first ran for office, you may recall you had a certain idea about 2-3 areas. Certainly it could be counted on one hand on which you're not going to change anybody's mind. And once you get elected, you realize that you probably double that within 2 years. And one of those issue areas on which you double it would be animal issues. It's really, really difficult to find compromise on animal issues because people are very, extremely passionate about it. I had dogs growing up. My daughter, Alice, who many of you have seen around the house floor, has a little Boston Terrier named Lily. And she loves Lily. She talks about Lily all the time. And I asked her this morning originally if she wanted to bring Lily to the hearing. She's like, well, I've got school. So she's in school right now. But I said, well, what would you say about this dog and cat breeder bill? And she said to me, now remember, Alice is 12 years old. But she said, well, you wouldn't put your kid in a place like that. I don't know why you'd put an animal in that place. Now, I grew up
of course, understanding that animals are not people. People are afforded rights in the Constitution, absolutely. However, many of you also grew up with some people who the way that they treated animals reflected strongly upon their character as a person and how they treated people later on in life. And I have multiple scenes from my childhood growing up as a young boy of other boys I associated with, and I remember distinctly the way that they treated some animals, and it had a deep effect on me and still does. So the idea of this is that we're going to make sure that if there's no adequate reason for you to be having animals in a condition or a factory like that, that we're going to regulate it. And we're going to establish that there are going to be some standards by which you must live up to, because those are the decent civilized standards that we have here in Minnesota. Section 1 of the bill defines commercial breeder anyone other than a hobby breeder who possesses or ownership interest and has and is breeding animals for sale or exchange, or for exchange in return for consideration, who possesses 10 or more adult intact animals who can produce more than 5 total litters of puppies or kittens every year. And before I go on, I should introduce Gert. Could you come up here and introduce yourself?
I'm Diane Dunker, and this is Gert, who I adopted in August of last year.
Okay, and if you could tell the committee how you adopted Gert.
Gert came from a USDA licensed breeder, and as I understand, the breeder had between 100 and 150 dogs, and the breeder wanted to relinquish a dozen of them, and as I understand it, because they were old or sick, and so Gert found her way into the Morrison County Humane Society, and I happened to be there volunteering for the day, and I have a soft spot for the old the old dogs who are not easily adoptable, and some of these breeder dogs have emotional issues, and she was shut down, and so I couldn't leave her in there. And so I took her and adopted her.
Thank you. Thank you for that. And thank you, Gert, for being here. Is Gert just shy from the lights? Or
This is Gert.
Okay. Gert is just chill. Okay.
Representative Lash, we have Gert's name, but would the witness please restate her name?
Diane Dunker.
Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Dunker. The reason why it's important to have Ms. Dunker bring Gert up here, members, is because this is an issue that is not going away. Every time someone discovers one of these facilities, or every time someone finds out that the animal that they bought from the back of a station wagon in the Home Depot parking lot in Owatonna all of a sudden has massive respiratory problems or dies within a year, and they don't know why, they're going to want to know why. Just like you would want to know with your own child, because you grow strong attachment and affection for your dog or your kitten, and it makes a big difference. So this will continue to come up at the Capitol until we address it. Now, the Section 1 also defines just the hobby breeders, and for those breeds who have fewer than 10 dogs or cats, produce 5 or fewer total litters per year. These hobby breeders would not be licensed or inspected. They would just be registered at no charge to them. Section 2 involves the Board of Animal Health is the licensing and inspection authority. It will begin granting licenses of July of 2014. There will be a range of costs set for the licensing depending on the size of the operation that they're producing these animals in. Section 3 is the standards of care. Commercial breeders have to comply with existing animal cruelty laws. And this is important, members, for this reason. Minnesota, as it stands right now, is a complaint-based state. So no one knows what goes on anywhere unless you, by happenstance, stumble onto one of these operations and discover deplorable conditions. At that point, you can then bring it to your local sheriff or your local law enforcement authority to say, wow, I saw this terrible operation. Now, by that time, of course, by the time you get back, the person knows that you stumbled on it, and they've cleaned up the operation, either sold off or gotten rid of the remaining animals. So there's essentially no enforcement ability whatsoever, which is why we need to address it in the way we are. The standards of care are established, as we already have in Minnesota, and complies roughly with the USDA regulations that are already in place. Individuals who are licensed by the USDA that sell to pet shops have to comply with these standards already. Section 4 involves investigations of how we investigate these complaints. Section 5 is civil enforcement, providing for correction order, civil penalties, and enforcement actions. Section 6 is the penalties. Section 7 is the licensing, account, and appropriations. And Section 8 is the hobby breeder registration. Members, the number of changes that have gone through, as I've stated, in this bill over the course of the past 6 years have been the product of much discussion. There will absolutely still be some dispute. And let there be no mistake about it. Everyone who's up here at the Capitol, when you have a bill that is the product of a hard-fought compromise, will have testifiers come up and say, I run a clean operation. I run a good operation. All of my puppies and kittens are taken care of. They're well-fed. They're exercised. They're cared for when they get sick. We don't socialize them with the other animals when they get sick. How can you come in and regulate me on this? Members, you know as well as I, we're not here to regulate them. They're already doing what they need to do. The people who don't come in here and testify are the people who need to be regulated, and we need to be extremely careful about shielding those bad actors with the testimony of individuals who are doing it right. It happens every time. If I had a nickel for every time you had a bad actor come in and testify against a bill that would regulate them, I'd be broke because they don't come in. Well, there is one exception. If people recall the equity stripping legislation we had about 6 years ago, there was one or two guys who were the worst offenders. They actually came in and testified. I was impressed. But other than that, it's the good actors that testify. So you won't hear, I seriously doubt you'll hear from any bad actors today, and I would hope that you would listen to my other testifiers that I have up here. Madam Chair.
Good morning.
Please state your name for the record.
I apologize, I have a cold. Madam Chair, representatives, my name is Dr. Lisa McCarger. I'm a veterinarian. And I'm here to testify in support of House File 84. Essentially, I have 2 points to make as to why I support this file. One is based on animal welfare issues. The other is public health issues. As a veterinarian, I was directly involved with the seizure and evaluation of animals from breeding facilities for 3 years while working at the Humane Society. Almost every animal that I examined from large-scale breeding facilities consistently showed similar symptoms and conditions. Poor body conditioning, being underweight, matted coats, urine and feces stained coats and skin, wounds, scabs, overgrown nails, severe dental disease, ear infections, external parasites, multiple species of internal parasites or worms. In addition, the vast majority of these dogs were highly unsocialized and fearful of normal environmental stimulation such as leashes, doorways, stairways, many to the point of aggression or sheer terror. I should point out I'm mentioning dogs mostly because I personally haven't seen that many cat breeder cases, so I just wanted to note that. In particular, I'd like to describe the condition of several dogs from just one of the breeding facilities that I was involved with during the seizure. It was a breeder of hunting dogs in Jackson County. There are 59 live breeding dogs that were seized, and 2 dead dogs were found on the property. They were seized as a result of a sheriff's investigation based on complaints from the community. One dog was euthanized immediately due to severe emaciation or starvation, dehydration, weakness, the inability to stand on his own, eye disease, and blindness. 58 of the 59 were covered in dried feces. 58 had moderate to severe dental disease. 43 dogs had fight wounds. 22 were positive for internal parasites, 38 were underweight, 12 of those were emaciated, and that just means to the point of almost death by starvation. 16 of them had skin infections, 15 had severe and painful ear infections, the ear canals were filled with pus. 3 had fresh lacerations on their faces and ears that required suturing immediately. 2 exhibited aggressive behavior towards people and had to be euthanized for that reason. So those highlight some of the animal welfare issues I have concerns with. But the public health concern is also very real and significant. These animals carry zoonotic parasites, and they're particularly concerning because these zoonotic parasites can be transmitted to people, particularly children and the elderly in our community. Filthy living conditions coupled with the immune suppression from the stress of being overcrowded in these facilities, pregnancy, repeated pregnancies, lactation cycles, all increase the incidence that these animals were going to be infected with and shedding these parasites into the environment. Some examples of these diseases are roundworm. It's the most common intestinal parasite found in dogs and cats. In people, it can cause blindness if it's infected in a person. It can infect body organs and include the brain and the central nervous system. Hookworms are another parasite that can be transmitted to people. They cause itchy and painful skin rashes or abdominal pain or bleeding if ingestion of the eggs occurs. Ringworm is a skin fungus that causes scaly or crusty rashes on people. Thercoptes is a skin mite that dogs carry that can cause rashes in people. Toxoplasma is a parasite that can cause flu-like symptoms, and in pregnant women it can actually cause abortion if they're coming into contact with the parasite. Giardia is another intestinal parasite that can cause severe cramps and diarrhea in people. Salmonella bacteria can be carried and cause a wide range of symptoms from diarrhea to death, and there are many others. These findings are unfortunately consistent and predictable for the veterinary staff that evaluate seized animals from large breeding facilities in Minnesota. The cases that have come to my attention are only the ones where people have seen the cruelty and reported it. Without the ability for inspections, there's no way of knowing the condition of the animals that are living in these facilities that aren't getting inspected. I believe that the passage of this bill would protect the physical and social welfare of the animals in breeding facilities, and it would also help protect the people who come in contact with these animals from acquiring a variety of zoonotic diseases. I urge your support of this House File 84. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Chair.
Any questions?
Okay. We have another testifier, Madam Chair.
Representative Howell.
You know, I can ask you to file my testimony if that's okay.
Yes, thank you. You have another witness here?
Good morning, Madam Chair. And
you state your name for the record.
My name is Keith Struff, and I am the senior investigator for the Animal Humane Society in Golden Valley. And to expound on the line of 6-year saga that Representative Lesh has mentioned here, I've been in front of these various committees testifying on this bill for so long now that I think I feel like that dog that follows you home and then you feed it and it never goes away. That's me. So the Animal Humane Society has 5 shelters in 5 different counties providing programs and services for people and animals all across the state of Minnesota. And I'm here to speak in strong support of HF 84. As a humane agent, one of my responsibilities is to respond to citizen complaints regarding animals that are subject to conditions and environments alleged to be in violation of the existing animal welfare chapter that we're currently using today. I'm confident that you've heard or read or seen some of the horrific cases that have been publicized over the years in regards to animals coming out of environments, whether they're small breeders or large. The great majority of these cases I've been the lead investigator on, and I think you have some photos in front of you that you've seen. I'm sure many of those photos and cases and animals are photos that I've personally taken and cases that I've personally handled. The pictures, they pretty much speak for themselves. I could bore you for hours on cases that I've seen, environments that I've seen, animals that I've seen, animals that range from dozens to perhaps hundreds of dogs, some stacked in cages, some running loose, some breeding indiscriminately. many sick, some are injured, some are diseased, some are dead, some are still dying. Many of these cases are symptomatic to improper isolation, improper ventilation, inadequate feed, inconsistent feed and water, untreated issues involving sores, rotting teeth, blindness, maggot-infested coats. The list goes on. Some of the environments require us to wear hazard material suits due to the staggering amount of feces, urine, excrement that's building up in the environment, improper ventilation. You can't breathe. You literally, the ammonia is so heavy, it takes your breath away. I've witnessed dogs being fed roadkill, amateur C-sections, whatever it takes to produce the product, which is the puppy or the kitten that's subsequently going to be sold to the public. Minnesota currently doesn't have any specific state language that regulates commercial dog and cat breeding facilities. There are no required inspections. There's no required registration. House File 84 provides regulation which is going to be preventative. It's going to allow inspections. We can address situations at breeding facilities before they escalate to the point where animals have to be seized. Existing law only allows me or other local law enforcement to respond after a complaint is filed, and that's important. So nearly every situation we walk into is either catastrophic or on the brink of being catastrophic. And by that time, it's typically too late. House File 84 will also allow the Board of Animal Health to identify, to correct, and to prevent these catastrophic environments before they develop. A uniform, statewide regulation will save municipalities and enforcement agencies alike money in the long term. The cost associated with seizing animals is exorbitant. Many times we have to go into a holding pattern, quarantine. State law requires us to hold those animals for 10 days. Each one of those days costs additional money. Veterinary care, all these things are quite burdensome to the agency that's involved. And currently the Animal Humane Society has been absorbing the great majority of those costs. And again, you know, keep in mind that law enforcement only hears about cruelty after it's discovered. So it's running. It's a rolling dynamic when we get there. It's not like a dog isn't being fed or watered and starting to look thin. These are catastrophic environments of which you're looking at in the photos. Some of these issues could be deterred if we had the ability to look or watch or be able to inspect prior to them starting to turn to that downhill trend. So it's like any regulatory action. We want to catch it before it becomes a significant problem and issue correction orders that'll take care of it. The costs are staggering. If you have 50, 60, 70, pick a number, 100, 150, 250, maybe 1,000 dogs on a given facility, and something goes catastrophic, those animals have to remove. They have to be removed. Local law enforcement has to work in concert with some local animal welfare agency to absorb that particular the costs associated with those with that kind of a seizure. If the breeder was given an opportunity to correct that, change it, improve it, come into compliance, then there would be no need for seizing these large-scale animals, and these environments would be kept to a minimum. Our intent is not to ban the breeding of cats and dogs. HF 84 is intended to supervise, inspect, and otherwise correct the problem before it develops and help these animals, both the adults and the puppies and cats or kittens that they produce, subsequent for sale. I strongly urge your support of House File 84, and I'd be happy to answer any questions you might have.
Thank you, Mr. Streff. You have additional witnesses?
That's all we have for witnesses, Madam Chair.
I believe we have, let's see, is there anyone here from the public that wishes to testify?
Well, Madam Chair, there are questions before they do.
How many do we have from the one, two? Okay, we'll take some questions now, and then we have five testifiers after that. Representative Howe.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I I'm a dog lover, had dogs all my life, and I've actually had a few litters of pups and decided that was too much work for me, so I don't do that anymore. You're going to register hobby breeders. They're going to have to annually register. If you're not going to inspect hobby breeders, then what's the registration for?
Madam Chair, Representative Howell, there's a huge underground industry going on right now. And as it stands right now, many of these sales, there's no sales tax on them whatsoever. One of the things we want to look at it as you increase your numbers, and if you have to pay sales tax on these sales, once you go from a hobby breeder to a commercial breeder, which can happen if you're on the edge, we want to make sure that we're looking at you like a commercial breeder, because that's how you're proceeding, or that's how you're operating. When you're under that, we absolutely don't care, but that's the whole point of it, so we know that when you go over the line from being a casual hobby breeder to a commercial breeder.
Representative Howe.
Thank you, Madam. So how will you know how many, if once I register as a hobby breeder, how will you know how many litters that my dogs have whelped? If I've got two dogs and I'm limited to so many litters a year, how will you know how many times my dogs have whelped the litters if I'm not required to be inspected?
We won't know unless, thank you, Madam Chair, we won't know unless you sell them. If you sell them and you enter in the stream of commerce and are part of the industry of buying and selling puppies and kittens, that's how we'll know. But if you're just having them and if you're giving away or something, it's going to be difficult for us to know.
Representative Howie.
So, and I'm not going to go down that line because I think that is, you know, that happens every day here, and I think that's going to be extremely difficult to track as far as those types of sales. But explain to me why this is different from other pets like horses, pot-bellied pigs, ferrets, those types of animals, and how are those being regulated today?
That's a great question. And animal cruelty gets a lot of attention throughout the state when it happens. You remember the case of the horses up by Duluth? But people's puppies and kittens, people's dogs and cats, that's the number one transaction in Minnesota. You go around and you go door knocking in your district, you see nearly everyone that has either a dog or a cat or both. And it impacts people deeply. Those separate issues about cattle or about hamsters or whatever, let someone else bring those up. Let the Department of Ag deal with the cattle issues. For the average person out there who are not a sophisticated operation, who aren't in the business of buying and selling cattle, so caveat emptor, let them know what's going on, look the gift horse in the mouth, as you will. The average person does not have the level of sophistication to understand the dog or the cat that they're buying, whether or not it's been raised in a healthy environment. So that's why we choose to focus on this, because it's by far the majority of the transactions that go on, and it impacts the most people. We have no intent to get into those other areas because we think the regulation provided for those areas are adequate, or it's just not on people's radar. But this definitely is.
And Mr. Streff, did you have something to add to that? Or?
Yeah, Madam Chair, Representative Howe, in the example that you gave, horses, ferrets, and some of these other animals are already covered. They're regulated under a different chapter. Horses are considered questionably pet and companion or livestock. A ferret is an exotic animal. And quite frankly, the hobby breeder isn't a big problem on our radar.
Thank you, Mr. Streff. You have a follow-up question? Or
I got additional questions, Madam Chair.
And how many more questions do you have?
Well, Madam Chair, it depends on which way the answers go, but I got at least two.
Okay. Mr. Howe.
Thank you, Madam Chair. How many breeder licenses do you expect to get?
Can you answer that? How many? The expectation of the physical note, Representative Howe,
is that we expect 475, although you know how fiscal notes go.
Yes. And I don't know if you know my background. I've spent over 15 years in doing in health, building, fire inspections, housing inspections. So I know what it takes to do inspections. I know the number of inspections a person can do. So if you've got 475 that you expect, give or take, how many inspections per day can an inspector do? And I understand you're looking at doing annual inspections of each one of those. Are you looking at one a day, two a day? What do you expect to do that with that? And then how is that follow-up? Because if you find one that's bad, because I've been in houses that have half a dozen ferrets going around. I've had places with 6 inches of feces in an apartment with a bad dog. One dog, one cat neglected 6 inches of feces in the apartment. We had to strip it to the stud walls. So I'm sensitive to the fact that, yeah, there's animal cruelty out there. But if you're looking to inspect places annually, and I have had a hard time keeping up with apartment inspections for rentals, it's an overwhelming thing if you don't have a plan to get it done. And if you've got this task to be on the Board of Animal Health, do they have the inspectors, the technical expertise, and the manpower to annually inspect 475 facilities? And what the follow-up that's going to take?
Madam Chair, Representative Howe, line 4.31 says, if after the pre-license inspection the commercial breeder has 2 consecutive years with no violations, the board shall inspect the commercial breeder at least every 2 years. And if there are any violations or if the board has cause, then it goes back to annually. So if someone is doing a good job, essentially we lay off. How that said, the number, 475 number that came up in the fiscal note is based on 6 years of conversations with these folks, but I think it would be worthwhile for our folks to talk to you in the wake of this and get your gut sense of whether or not it's achievable. I think after this much talk, it is, but there's going to be different opinions on the table, and based on your unique experience, I'd like to get your input on it. And I would add that, Madam Chair, that this bill, we've worked our tails off on it. However, we also expect that it's not a totally finished product. There will be some tweaking around the edges between here and the floor, and I want to get that done based on not just Representative Howe's comments, but others too.
Also, I believe we have the Board of Animal Health, the director here, if there's questions that he can answer. And did you have a follow-up question, Representative Howe?
I will just let it go. I guess, Madam Chair,
Representative Howe,
if you could answer, have you looked at this? Have you prepared people to undertake this task?
And Dr. Hartman, if you'd introduce yourself to the record, please.
Sure, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Bill Hartman. I'm the Executive Director of the Board of Animal Health and the State Veterinarian. And yes, indeed, for the last 6 years, we've looked at bills for dog and cat breeder inspections at the Board of Animal Health. We've written many fiscal notes for different bills, and we did write a fiscal note for this bill. One of the difficulties that we have is estimating what the population of dog and cat breeders is. And so we've done the best we can in this fiscal note. And if you look at the fiscal note, it would add in the first year 4.5 people to the Board of Animal Health, and in subsequent years 5.5. To the question of are we prepared and do we have the technical expertise, no. We have not done this in the past. This is kind of a new venture for the Board of Animal Health. We have a cadre of veterinarians and animal health technicians, so we're the right agency to administer a program if you pass this bill, but it would require extensive training on our part by our employees.
Thank you, Dr. Herman. We have members with other questions. If we can
just one more follow-up.
quick question, Representative Howe.
Thank you, Madam Chair, for allowing me to proceed. But aren't there counties out there? I come from a county that I believe does a great job at monitoring this. Aren't there counties and aren't there local levels of government that do a great job on monitoring this very issue?
Dr. Hartman.
Madam Chair and Representative, we don't have a lot of information about what's going on out there right now, but yes, I believe that there are counties that do and townships and cities that do a very good job of this, but we're not sure exactly what's going on at this point.
Okay, Madam Chair, if I could.
Representative Lesh.
It's true, Representative, there are some local units of government that do well. I, as a prosecutor for 12 years in St. Paul, I remember one of my first trials out the gate about 10 years ago, to 11 years ago, was a guy on a really wealthy man on Summit Avenue who had some mental health issues, and he was a collector. And he collected, I mean, you go into his house and they find these $300 boxes of software unopened. He'd buy all this stuff. Well, he also did it. I mean, who cares if there's new stuff laying around a house? Well, he also did it by going to pet stores. And they went in there, and it was really bad. There were some animals that were still left alive. But the only reason they found out is because a few of these animals got out and attacked the neighbor cat. So then it was a complaint. Absolutely, it's complaint-based. But if we don't... And it's not going to reach everyone still. I mean, a guy like that is not going to register... in any way, but so there will be things that slip through the cracks. But to answer your question, yes.
Okay, we have other members with questions. Representative Holberg.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Lesh, you stated that the reason for registering the hobby breeders is to know whether or not they're collecting sales tax. How would that work?
Well, if you do a transaction, Madam Chair, Representative Holberg, someone's got to pay sales tax on the transaction.
Well, Representative Holberg.
Madam Chair and Chair Lesh, I don't see any allowance for the Board of Health, Animal Health, to have access to Department of Revenue records. I mean, I'm just curious how you think that would work.
Representative Lesh. Madam Chair, I mean, if that's something, maybe there's someone else going to answer it. When I answered that, that was what I recall from our discussions a while back and how we were going to determine it. But, I mean, if that's the case and there needs to be some record issue, I don't know. But I do know that there's a certain point under, I believe it's $600, to which you're not obligated to pay. Okay. I guess we do have an answer, Madam Chair.
Hi, Madam Chair, committee members. My name is Nancy Minion, and I've been working with Representative Lesh on this issue for several years, and I also run a nonprofit animal rescue organization where we see a lot of these animals coming into our programs. With the state sales tax, anybody, any business who sells merchandise, even my adoptions, we have to pay state sales tax on the adoption of an animal. So any breeder who sells an animal, they're required by law to pay state sales tax. So there isn't anything in the bill that's going to make them pay state sales tax. They should already be doing that. What happens with the state of Minnesota is anytime there's a licensing provision, from what I understand in a law, the Department of Revenue is provided with that information, so then they can check to make sure that the people licensed, be it liquor licenses or any other licenses, are paying state sales tax.
Well,
does that answer the question?
Representative Holberg.
Madam Chair, generally you would have to get some type of authority by the board to have access to income tax data. That's some of the most highly protective data in the state, and I don't see that here, but I'm going to back up to the whole issue. Your testifier basically said hobby breeders are not a big problem. And when I look at your definition of a hobby breeder in the bill, and I think 90% of the opposition to your bill would go away if you'd get rid of this hobby breeder thing. But when you look at the definition, I'm guessing that any person in the state of Minnesota that has an intact animal would qualify under this definition, because zero is fewer than five. So you don't set a you said fewer than five. I think that you're drawing a lot of opposition to this bill. All the testimony that I heard was about these big operations. And if that's what you're trying to get at, and given the controversy around this issue, it may be beneficial to stick with that as the issue and not require anybody in the state that has an intact animal to register for some type of listing to go on a website where, as far as I can tell, you're not inspecting them, you're not collecting a fee from them, you're just putting them on a list somewhere. I don't think you're getting any bang for your buck, and if you really want to concentrate on what the problem is, let's concentrate on the commercial breeders and not make everybody in the state of Minnesota that has an intact animal sign up as a hobby breeder.
Madam Chair, Representative Holberg, if you read the definition on page 2, line 6, they have to meet all the thresholds for a hobby breeder. They have to be a person who possesses and has ownership interest in and is engaged in the business of breeding animals for sale. So an average person who's got animals, they're not in the business of breeding for sale. And they also, you know, have under 10 animals. But again, that the definition is they have to be in the business of breeding for sale, not just an average pet owner.
Oh.
And again, they're not inspected, licensed. That provision on page 9, lines 8 through 11, that was just added this year. That provision wasn't in the last 6 years, and we still had the same opposition. So to me, it's not reducing the opposition. They're still coming out opposing the same as they have every other year. And the reason that it was put in this year was in order for the Board of Animal Health to have easier access to, once a breeder goes from a certain threshold of animals into the commercial breeder definition, they already have them just registered, and then they kick into the commercial breeder licensing.
And Representative Howe?
And it's Holberg, Madam Chair, but...
Holberg, I'm sorry.
That's okay. Okay, so you could have a dog or a cat and have one, breed them once in a 10-year period and have to register as a hobby breeder. And I still don't, I mean, I sure would like to know how you're, is the Board of Animal Health going to access the income tax records of everybody in the state that has to register as a hobby breeder to see, we run a business that collects sales tax, we turn it in, I'm not aware. We have to sign up with the Department of Agriculture because we're a tree service. We're on a list, but I'm not aware of any authority of the Department of Agriculture to review our income tax statements to see what type of receipts we're turning in.
Well, Madam Chair.
Representative Lesch.
I'm assuming there's some way that the Department of Revenue can establish that. If you fail to register as a tree service, then there's got to be some penalty for that, I'm assuming. Representative Holberg.
Madam Chair, in the case of tree services, we pay $25 a year to the Department of Agriculture to be on a tree service registry that we, as far as I know, have never given the authority of the Department of Agriculture to review income tax records of tree services on the registry. The income tax records are the most, probably other than health records, the most highly protected records in the state of Minnesota, and I don't see anything here in your bill that is going to provide for the Department of Animal Health to search the income tax records of all of the people that have to sign up because they had a dog or a cat that had one litter in 10 years.
Well, if I may, Madam Chair, let me use this example. In the city of St. Paul, I own rental property. There are other people who suddenly found themselves rental property owners recently as well, too, because they moved out of their house and they're trying to sell it, and they can't sell it. They're like, oh, geez, I need to rent this thing out. Now, in the city of St. Paul, you are required to register your rental property. There are plenty of people who don't even know that. So what happens is the officials down at the city of Department Inspections and Licensing scour Craigslist ads and other kinds of ads in the city of St. Paul, the neighborhoods that are listed on there, and they look at the address, and they'll call them and say, hey, you're renting your place? And they say, yeah, you're renting a place. How much? Oh, what's the address? And then they'll go and they'll check the records to see if it's registered. And if they're not, then the person gets a nice little letter saying, hey, by the way, you're renting this out. You need to pay the $50 registration fee. I'm assuming that's the similar kind of way that this will go down. I don't know. If there's a hole in the bill because of that, we'll absolutely fix it. But those are the logistics of enforcement I'm not familiar with.
Okay, members, we have 15 minutes left. So we have Representative Johnson. Next.
Madam Chair, Mr. Chair, do you know what the percentages of counties or cities that have ordinances dealing with dogs and also with the kennel licensing requirements of these?
There you go. Sure, Madam Chair, Representative Johnson, Sherman County, Stearns County, Mille Lacs County, are three counties with the breeder and kennel ordinance. Each start licensing at four or more dogs over 6 years of age. Stearns County and Sherman County cap a commercial kennel at no more than 40 dogs over 6 months of age. Mille Lacs County states in no case shall the max.
I'm not talking,
Representative Johnson.
Sure. I was not talking about these particular. What is the percentage of the cities and counties in the entire state that has dog and cat ordinances?
I don't
know. I know the county.
Representative Johnson, please speak through the chair.
Mr. Chair, I know the county that I worked in and all the surrounding counties. If you had more, it varied depending with your on lake property or in rural property in the county area. Anything over more than four dogs, if you're by a lake, three dogs, they had to have a kennel license. And to get that kennel license, it required a public meeting and applications through the zoning, and zoning would go out and inspect those regularly to make sure they met the qualifications, they listed the number of dogs. Going after these so-called hobby breeders, they would have to get the county license, those would be inspected already. Also, you have the issue with farmers. A lot of farmers in this rural and greater Minnesota, they have more than five dogs just to work on it. So that's why I'm wondering if you know what the percentage of the counties that actually have kennel and dog ordinances.
Representative Lesh.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Johnson, I don't know the exact percentage, and even the percentage that have anything on the books, enforcement is really squishy. In general, as we state, it's complaint-based in general if they don't go out and inspect. So, no, I don't know the exact percentage that have variations on what we want to do.
Representative Johnson.
Madam Chair, Representative Lewis, what percentage do you think that, well, you're aware that USDA requires licensing now, and you're claiming this will stop the complaint-based finding of these large-scale operations that are doing this. The humane officer there could answer this. What percentage of the places that you find are actually USDA licensed?
Madam Chair, Representative Johnson, I don't know the specific percentage, but it would be very low. And there's no consistency as well. The great majority of these smaller townships in the southern part of the state, and so far northern part of the state, don't have any requirements such as you mentioned. If they are, they issue it at a board. They put it on the agenda at the board. Some of these counties don't even require an on-site inspection before they pass. I think what you're referring to is a CUP, a conditional use permit, and or an IUP, where that's issued by the local unit of government, whether that be at the municipal level or the county level. And as far as USDA, a breeder of any size does not elects whether or not they want to be USDA licensed. And if they drop that USDA license, then they operate as a point of sale through the internet, and they sell right at the retail level. They don't go through a broker.
Madam Chair, if we could, I think some of these questions might be answered by opposition. I think we have five on the list for opposition testimony. But they're going to have to keep it short because we don't have a lot of time left. But if we can hear from them, that might be worthwhile.
Members, if we can finish the questions after that. We have five presenters. We'll try to keep it short, and then we can go to questions after that. I'm going to bring members of the public.
Madam Chair.
Representative Scott.
Thank you. I'm just wondering if the author would consider, you know, laying this over and so we can, or continuing this hearing so we can, everybody can be heard and all the questions can be answered. If we reach the end of time and we still have testifiers and still have questions, and this is, you know, an issue that's been worked on for several years, and I think it's worthy of you know, continuing the conversation.
Representative Lesh.
Madam Chair and Representative Scott, I would consider, I'd like to hear what the opposition is going to say first, or whether or not any of their questions are cleared up. I think a lot of these questions have been repeated from previous times and get thrown up again, the same question. So I'm not interested in rehashing the same ones, but to the extent that we have new questions regarding this bill that would be worthwhile, yeah, I'd be interested in.
Thank you.
I'd be open to doing that.
Let's start with Julie Gurdon. If you'll state your name, and please keep your comments brief. Thank you.
My name is Julie Gurdon, Madam Chair, Representatives. Good morning. Thank you for allowing me the opportunity to speak with you today. I'm going to skip right to that. I am a professional dog breeder. I started out as a young child enjoying raising puppies with my grandfather. They'd have one litter a year on the farm. It became a love and a passion of mine. And as I growing up in the city, I spent summers on my grandparents' farms and grew to have a love of animals. And at one point decided that when I grew up, because I was told when I grew up I could be anything I wanted to be, I was wanted to own my own farm, and I wanted to have animals and raise puppies and kitties. I was a professional business person working in downtown Minneapolis. I purchased my first home in South Minneapolis, and I started to work on my dream of raising animals as a hobby. I raised cats. Is it possible to pass around some photographs at all? And I did that while I was still working, trying to save money to one day get to own a small hobby farm. After about 9 years of doing that, I was able to finally move out away from South Minneapolis. I moved to the city of Nowthen, which is in Anoka County, on a 9-acre hobby farm, and there I started to raise dogs once I had the space to do so. Pardon me, I have a cold. In my city, I was required to get two separate permits or licenses in order to own more than five dogs. Now, that's their limit without permit and without inspection. In order to own anything more than that, even though you live on an acreage, you need to go through an approval process. And from there, I'll try to go back to my notes. So I first had to get permission to have a commercial kennel license to own more than five dogs on a 5-acre property. And I was also required to get an interim use permit in order to be able to conduct a business that involved customers coming to my home. This process was lengthy, expensive, and stressful. During this application process, I had to have many inspections on different occasions, which were conducted by the city building inspector animal control officers, town board members, and planning and zoning committee members. Several restrictions were established for my business, and as is typical when granting permits that involve animals, an annual inspection of my entire home, buildings, and animals is required. I also have to maintain what every now and then resident has to for their dogs, and that is to get rabies shots and do individual licensing for each of the dogs that I own. Above and beyond that, to receive approval, I had to grant the city the ability to enter my home on any given day that they choose. Two public meetings were required, and the meeting announcements were published in the newspaper. The city also mailed out individual letters sharing my letter of application for my property to the 46 acreage owners that lived within certain distance of my property, inviting them to attend my public hearing so they could voice their opinions. After a much lengthy process, in the end, all approvals were granted, and that's where I am today. I have over 24 years experience from that very first litter that I had up until today. When I was working downtown Minneapolis, it took me about 15 years before I could go from a hobby status to a full-time professional breeder, which was my goal. That was my dream as a little girl. That was my American dream, was to not have to drive that one-hour commute into downtown Minneapolis every day and to get away from the airplane noise and raise wonderful puppies and find great homes for them. But beyond my local government's annual inspection requirement, like many breeders...
Gurney, could you sum up your opposition? Our time is limited here.
I'm here representing the Minnesota Pet Breeders Association, and we believe that this bill is unnecessary just because it's already being handled at the city and county levels for licensure. We also believe that we want protection for all dogs equally, not just dogs that are owned by dog breeders. We're also concerned about excessive regulation having unintended consequences, not allowing people to be able to extend beyond a hobby breeding status, not being able to choose for themselves this as a profession. Our industry has decreased by almost 50% over the last few years, and it's going to start impacting Minnesotans' ability to be able to go and choose well-bred puppies by professionals. It might just end up being done willy-nilly by people who really don't know what they're doing. The one-year, you know, I hate the label, but backyard breeders. So,
we have a question for this witness, Representative Booger.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ballpark figure, I have one and a quick follow-up. Ballpark figure, what do you get per animal when you sell them?
I'd rather not answer personal questions. I can answer industry questions. We have breeders who sell puppies for $100, and we have some that sell them for $2,000 a piece.
Thank you.
Representative Neuberger.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The reason I bring that up is I'll be really quick. I'm from Sherburne County, one of the very regulated areas. About once every 3 years, my kids show up with a free kitten because they know I'm weak. And you don't have cats, they have you. Suffice to say, where I come from, you cannot drive down any county road in the spring without seeing a sign, kittens, $20, or free kittens. I cringe because I know that I'm probably going to be a victim. What concerns me about the bill is the whole definition of hobby breeder here. Where I come from, if you put a price tag on a cat or a dog that protects that cat and that dog, it makes it a little more difficult to bring it home, and people are less apt to just grab a cat or grab a dog and bring it home like my daughters are. That having that price tag attached to that animal, it cuts down on the number of people who pick them up on a whim. What concerns me is if this goes through the bill in its current form, you're going to have people here that are going to look at this and they're going to say, hey, if I charge $20 or if I charge $30 for this dog or this cat, now I'm going to be labeled as a hobby breeder and I'm going to have all of these regulations. There's going to be an intimidation factor here that wasn't there before. And you're going to get a lot more of the free kittens and the free puppies instead of the ones for $20. And in that case, you're going to have the people that adopt these animals aren't going to be as caring because they won't have a financial investment in these animals. I'm just speaking from the area that I come from. So I'm really concerned about the whole definition and the whole aspect of the hobby breeder definition in this. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Ms. Gurdon. And we have Andrea Piper.
Hi, my name is Andrea Piper. Just quickly about me, veterinary technician certified since 94. I'm an animal control officer for the city of Minneapolis. Not here to represent them. I'm here to represent myself as a hobby breeder. I enjoy going to dog shows with the little French bulldogs I breed. I have about a litter a year, which would make me the hobby breeder. I like that we're working towards, if we're going to have to do this, this bill has gone from being the bad term of the puppy mill bill to the breeder bill, which at least sounds a little better. I did notice in Section 8, it was stated that the hobby breeder would not be inspected. That is not in the bill. It says that they would not have to register and that there would be no fees. It does not say that they would not be inspected. With every dog I sell, I keep my name on any animal that's intact so that if there is any issue with a person, they can't breed that animal without me saying that they can breed the animal. And I keep that on those animals so that they can be shown, they can be enjoyed as an intact animal, but they can't be bred without my input on it. And that would mean that that's going to add to my numbers of animals of owner interest, because even though they live in, I have some in Wisconsin, Iowa, Illinois, I have one in Alaska. It has my name on it. That's making me an owner of over 20 animals.
Ms. Piper, if you could finish, we're running out of time.
Well, Madam Chair, maybe I could do this. In light of the testifier's comments and a couple other areas, I'm open because I'd like to vote on this, moving on to the next committee where people could testify on it. I'm open to removing the hobby breeder provisions at this point and have a longer discussion about them and in a subsequent committee, but it may make it for more palatable so we can vote on it, move it to the next committee, and have people move on. There will be an opportunity to testify on other remaining provisions at subsequent stops. However, that's my proposal right now. I would move to remove Section 8, lines 9.8 through 9.11, as well as... Section 1, Subdivision 10, lines 2.6 through 2.9.
Thank you.
And I still, Madam Chair, I still want to talk about it because I think it's valid, but I hear the testimony of the opposition, and it might make for better conversations going forward.
Thank you, Representative Lesh.
Madam Chair.
Restate that motion here.
Don't we need a 24-hour notice of this, ma'am? We don't.
Representative
Strike. It's an amendment, is it not?
I'm sorry, Madam Chair. I would just point out to me there are other provisions that point out to hobby breeder in the bill, so we can't take out the definition. This would merely take out the enforcement provision for now, or the general prohibition. So, just the first. Section 8, for now, take that out.
Representative Lesh moves that we remove Section 8, lines 9.8 through 9.11. Representative Urso.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I agree that's probably a good move, removing it. But I would suggest when you look back at the definition of it, that I agree with Representative Holberg that currently it seems too broad. If someone owns animals that they haven't spayed or neutered for whatever reason, perhaps because they're showing them or whatever, fewer than five, I agree, includes zero and it includes one. And we could be concerned that if someone, if an animal inadvertently has a litter of puppies or kittens, you're faced with the choice, sell them, give them away, dump them in the woods, or otherwise dispose of them. And I don't want to provide an incentive for some of the less palatable choices in that constellation of choices. And it doesn't seem like someone who happens to own a few dogs and cats and has one litter and chooses to sell them to people ought to really fall under some kind of registration provision. And then I just wanted to note that I see that you have the definition at the beginning of it, subdivision 2, that an animal for this purpose means dog or cat, but that's been a source of some confusion in some of the emails when people are scanning through the bill and they see references to how many animals you have and so on. I know for the sake of the ease of language throughout the bill, animal appears many times, but making sure that people know that this is not intended to cover anything other than dogs and cats is a good thing. So,
Madam Chair, that's kind of you, so we can work on that. Also, I would remind folks that there's not a court in the state that would consider if you had a garage sale that they'd consider you in the business of selling 10-year-old China. So, if we could vote on it, Madam Chair.
Okay, we have a motion to remove Section 8. Additional discussion? Representative Scott?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I know we still have some people that have not had the opportunity to testify, and they may have come from some distance. And I know I have some questions regarding the standards of care in Section 3 on page 5.
Representative Scott, can we deal with the motion first, and then we can...
All right, I just want to encourage the author to lay this over, and we'll continue hearing it next week.
Thank you, Representative. Well, all those in favor of the motion, say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Those opposed? Motion carried.
Madam Chair, I heard Representative Scott's comments about the remainder of the bill. There are multiple stops on this, Representative Scott, so there will be ample time to discuss it and talk about it, but I do want to keep the bill moving, members.
Okay, we have additional members of the public. Representative Scott?
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair. Is there a huge rush on this bill? I mean, to me, this has been waiting. You know, you've been working on this for some time. It seems like it has momentum. You're getting the parties to come together. But I feel like we need to, you know, this committee has some purview, and I feel like some of those issues need to be addressed here. Is there an immediate hurry for this? Or I understand it's your committee and you want to get it through, but I think it would be good to have at least another half an hour's worth of discussion on it.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative Scott. It's not that. It's that there are the provisions in this bill require stops at multiple other committees. So there will be absolutely adequate time to discuss those, and especially the folks that came here and testified today testified on issues not related to things that are directly under the purview of this committee. So those other committees will consider those provisions that relate to their jurisdiction, and I think people have ample time. I am sensitive to the idea that people have come from other areas to testify on it, but because of the multiple other opportunities, I feel satisfied that their comments will be heard, both on the record and off with me in private, and that's why I'd ask we move it on, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Representative. We have William Lozito.
Madam Chair,
if
we could vote on it, we've already passed the time for the committee. You will have an opportunity to speak. People will have an opportunity to speak on it.
Members, we have 3 minutes till another committee comes in. Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, Representative Lesh, is there anyone here that's actually going to talk about a civil law provision?
I haven't heard one yet.
Right, I haven't either, but so I was just asking if anyone here was testifying about a civil law provision.
Do we have somebody raising their hand behind you? Will you approach, please, and state your name?
We're not talking about animals. We're talking about regulations.
My
My name is Valerie Mugley, and I'm from South Haven, Minnesota. I am a breeder. I am a hobby breeder. However, under this bill, I would not qualify as a hobby breeder because I have more than 10 dogs. But I train and compete all of my dogs in agility. For those of you who don't know what that is, you might have seen it on television where dogs are jumping over jumps and weaving through poles and tunneling under tunnels and things like that. I would not qualify as a hobby breeder. But there are a number of considerations as far as the civil issues here, because for one thing, it's very, very difficult to regulate breeding operations because there are so many different breeds, and that's why having organizations like AKC, which self-regulate. In fact, my pictures are going to be passed around. Those are pictures of my puppies and my dogs. For example, if you set a standard that the kennel has to be such a size or something like that, the fact is that a toy poodle doesn't need the same area as a Great Dane. Okay, there are a lot of breed specific things having to do with weather and things like that.
Madam Chair, we have a question here, Representative.
Madam Chair, Hillstrom. This is all really important stuff, mm-hmm. but that is everything you've talked about is going to be in another committee. So civil law has a very narrow area of jurisdiction. And so I really want to make sure that if people want to talk about the civil law issues, that we talk about that, because we're going to hear it in a lot of other committees.
Well, we're already being regulated at multiple levels, as Julie had testified.
We have one more minute here, so do you have somebody else that's testifying with you? Or?
Well, I agree. I mean,
please say your name for the record.
Natasha Podratz. Can you hear me?
Mm-hmm. If you could keep it to the civil issue, what Representative Hillstrom was speaking to?
I guess I'm nervous here. We've already, even small hobby breeders to be on here, we're already regulated by our counties. We're regulated by our clubs. USDA already regulates commercial breeders. I mean, I just feel like to be overtaxed and overregulated, people have a choice to buy where they want, where to buy their dog. GERD is a sad...
Okay, we're going to have to stop. We have another committee coming. Thank you for...
I would urge the committee
to... We have
to
Representative Lesh moved to that continue. House File 84 be passed and referred to the Committee on Public Safety, Finance, and Policy. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
And those opposed?
No.
Motion passed, and we are adjourned. Yeah.